Hey, Get Your Fresh Bizcast here. I'm DC Dennison. This week, Andrew Caffrey on tracking and location technologies. Then, Robert Weissman on the Google effect and nanotechnology in the spotlight at Boston's Museum of Science. First up, Andrew Caffrey. Andrew Caffrey, you just wrote the centerpiece for the innovation section on location technology. It's a fascinating story. And what's changed to make this more real these days?
Well, the technology to track somebody and find somebody has been around for a little while in either crude form or in very defined form. What's happened lately is that simply mobile computing has really come of age, and the networks that enable mobile computing have become quite robust and can handle the amount of data necessary to do tracking, navigational, kind of sophisticated technology like triangulation to figure out where someone is and then move that data back and forth both over a network, a communications network, and then have it appear in a usable format on a mobile device. Mm-hmm. In the old days, you know, mobile telephones could do things like phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
Today,
yeah,
you can, right. You know, you can buy clothing while mapping out, your around the world vacation on a mobile handset because it can handle that kind of data. And so that's what's gone on. The mobile computing world mm-hmm. has kind of grown up some enough to accommodate these much more sophisticated technologies that bring in other things, other kinds of old-fashioned like triangulation mm-hmm. and the like, and just really converge it all through that mobile system.
Device, yeah. Or system, yeah. I notice on my cell phone there's a little indicator that says it's GPS enabled, so it's ready.
It's ready, yeah. Right? But that's sort of a limited dimension.
Mm-hmm.
But the neat thing about what's happening with location-based services, location technologies, is they keep adding different functionalities that expand the dimension.
Yeah.
You could have a GPS-enabled phone mm-hmm. that will tell you where you are and give you some crude navigational things. You could have a GPS-enabled phone that can transmit, that can send back and forth, so other people could know where you are.
Yeah,
and then you
right.
could have
right.
a phone that has a GPS functionalities
yeah.
because they're able to miniaturize these various functionalities and combine them into these terrifically tiny little mobile devices that we're now using.
So this technology has always been just over the horizon. And I know you plunged in, as you always do. And what struck you as being, like, real?
Well, the most real thing is being done quite broadly, which is particularly in the shipping and trucking industry, where they use GPS-enabled cell phones or other kind of devices to do their logistics,
yeah.
which is incredibly
right.
important
yeah.
in the shipping and trucking industry to do most efficient dispatching, to find
yeah.
where this truck is and that truck is. You know,
right.
you get these emails from REI or L.L. Bean,
mm-hmm.
you know, your package is
right.
en route. The way they know that is that back at the data center, they're the GPS signal from that shipping pallet
yeah.
is beaming back to them saying, you know, we're crossing mid-Ohio now,
yeah.
you know?
Wow.
And so they can say, well, at that speed,
yeah.
it's going to take two more days to get to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
yeah.
it's en route, and we expect arrival on such and such a date.
Yeah.
Because they just happen to know when they sent that email where that
yeah.
package is at that very moment. So that's been in play, but now the issue is, all right, how can we make that even more interactive?
Yeah.
Why not, say, you know, layer on top of that other things? Where's a restaurant? I'm downtown.
Oh, yeah. That's
okay.
Yeah.
Where's a restaurant? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, we ported into the database the location of all these restaurants based on their coordinates, and we can tell you there's one two blocks over. Okay.
Yeah.
I looked that up. As soon as I do that, the merchant's computer sends me the menu. Not just the stock menu, but today's menu.
Yeah.
The merchant knows that I've eaten here before because my data is stored in their computer. They know I happen to like escargot. They say, well, we've gotten a fresh shipment of escargot today.
Yeah.
We can whip up a terrific meal for you? Or did you know that the person you had dinner with last week is actually has a reservation for tomorrow night? Would
now,
you like
no,
to
wait
come?
A minute. Now you're getting way ahead, though.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, they can begin to match these discrete things which they can do by themselves.
Yeah.
Buddy matching.
Yeah.
They can begin to pull all this stuff together in these sort of, you know, muscled up multi-application things.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It might look like a bit of a traffic jam right now.
Yeah.
But in a year or 2 years, some of this stuff is going to be very common.
Yeah, wow. So what are some of the examples you bring up in your story? I mean, I think you spent a lot of time, I know, drilling down and finding, okay, here's where this thing is.
Could happen, right.
Yeah.
All right, well, but what's neat right now is that we're getting a lot of real-life trials of some of this stuff. And the one that I found that I really gripped on is one that I think a lot of people can empathize with. This is in a healthcare setting where or a person setting where you're worried about where a person is, whether it's a child or an elderly person. Out in Wisconsin at a very large old soldier's home, a veteran's home, like a 300-acre campus with dozens of buildings and lots of something like 750 residents live on that campus. Many of them are very old and in various stages of dementia or other kinds of infirmities that make their movements a potential danger to themselves. Out there, they're testing a tracking technology where a group of elderly residents who place themselves at risk when they start moving around are carrying these things, and they pick up their the radio signal through a Wi-Fi network that's been installed around the campus. And that is mapped back to a server so they can see where these people are at any given moment. And then they've done something really neat, which is to kind of like create electronic fences around various places so that if my wired device gets near this fence, it sets off an alarm. And their alarm right now is actually wired to create an audio alert over the public address system. And what it will say is they'll, say, put a fence around a stairwell on the third floor of Building A, for example. And Herman, who can't go up and down stairs, and he got too close to the stairwell, is in danger of falling down the stairs. We've programmed the system that if Herman's little tag, which we've ID'd by XXYZZZ, gets near that particular fence, the alarm goes off.
I see.
And an audio alert will go over the PA system that will say a resident is near stairwell 3A in building XX. Somebody should go look. And they could actually see. They won't tell anybody over the address system, but on the computer it'll say it's actually Herman.
Oh, wow.
And so one staff who knows Herman will run up and try to get to Herman before he gets too close to the top of the stairs.
Wow.
They're trying that now. They determined that it works, and that it works pretty accurately. Their next question is to tune the accuracy and see if they could adopt it broadly across the campus, which would take it from a small group of residents to literally hundreds.
Yeah, that's a really compelling example, because you want people to have freedom to walk around. If someone was in a home like that, and a campus, you know, you wouldn't want to say, you have to stay, Herman, you have to stay in the house. You'd want to say, you know, take a walk, do things. And it's a liberating technology, not a constraining technology.
Exactly. Yeah. You would think that your first reaction is, well, we're going to put them on an electronic leash.
Yeah, right.
But in essence, what you're really doing is you're taking the physical fences and walls that are keeping them inside, and you're pushing them way out in various places to the boundaries of the safe area.
Yeah.
You're actually saying, we know he's safe here.
Yeah.
Okay? As long as we know he doesn't, between here and there, wander over to this other place.
Yeah.
So rather than lock him up because we worry he might go over to that other place, we can set a system that'll let us know and give the liberates them rather than puts a ball and chain on them.
Yeah.
It's a really neat idea that way.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the local hospitals are doing some stuff with this.
Right. Now, their healthcare has a great need of knowing where stuff is.
Yeah.
Especially a busy urban hospital, where if you've ever been in an emergency room, they sometimes look quiet, but underneath all that quiet is a lot of back and forth of who's what where.
Right.
And or who isn't what where,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so they're starting by slapping radio tags on equipment that they need to find in a hurry. If you can imagine an urban emergency department is not an emergency room. It's literally a sprawling department. And they have dozens of pieces of equipment they may need in a quick moment.
Yeah.
And they need to, where's that ventilator?
Yeah.
The ventilator is in room 12 because we have an icon on our computer that says it's sitting in room 12
wow.
where it's the radio tag is being picked up by on our Wi-Fi network.
Yeah.
Okay. What's so complicated about taking that radio tag and slipping it in the pocket of Dr. Jones?
Yeah.
We need Dr. Jones. We can page him.
Yeah.
Dr. Jones, please come. Dr. Jones is upstairs in a trauma room.
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Jones is upstairs in a trauma room, and he's with a patient who has a radio tag that tells us that patient is a severe case and Dr. Jones is going to be with him for an hour.
Huh.
Or the radio tag tells us it's a patient who's just got a cut or a bruise and we can interrupt and call Dr. Jones down for an emergency.
Wow.
This is the kind of stuff that medicine is examining right now in hospitals like Beth Israel, Mass General. How can we take this stuff, put it on humans, and then make the medical system more efficient and smarter?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because when you talk about, you know, escargot and lattes, that's, you know, that's one level of...
It's fun and all well.
Yeah,
and good.
Yeah. But when you talk about ventilators, then, you know, you're talking about these incredibly high stakes, and that's where the technology will probably get sort of sorted out and bullet tested.
Right, right. And the issue, of course, is for the kind of accuracy. Is the price point for the level of accuracy you need where it is right now, if you wait a year. I mean, we see, you know, price of chips are just dropping like a stone.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, at what point is there your return, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
If we pay extra now, will we get a big return on investment, increased efficiency, fewer mistakes, et cetera, in the time we would otherwise wait for the price point to come down? And that's exactly the kind of stuff that the hospitals are examining.
Yeah, yeah. Last question, LoJack's involved in this.
Right,
right. Local company. How are they getting involved in this?
Well, LoJack is clearly shown that its technology works where it slaps this little secret black box.
That's right, right. We
and
know
hides
that,
it.
Yeah.
You know, the LoJack's big deal is not so much that it's able to track things, it's that it can hide its tracking device.
Oh,
they're big into the covert aspect, okay?
Right.
So LoJack has logically looked at where else can their technology be applied to find something that's gone missing. They've expanded to motorcycles and to laptop computers.
Right.
Obviously, in a corporate world, what's on a laptop computer can be awfully valuable. And a big area for them is the transportation of hazardous car materials in an age of worries about domestic terrorism. Could somebody hijack a cargo? Okay. So in the course of looking at how else could their technology be ported over to another application, and what would the needs be to adapt it in order to maintain its covertness?
Yeah.
What other markets could this be used for? And they look and say, well, it obviously could be used to track a human, but which human market, what markets for human cargo are most amenable to our technology?
Mm-hmm.
And there they're looking at, they've asked for permission from the FCC to use the radio band, the public safety radio band on which their frequency is broadcast, for permission to track other things which aren't currently allowed under current rules, hazardous materials, and also people.
Mm.
And they want to look at it in terms of a market for which there is an uncontested need to track people, a voluntary demand. And that leads them to populations like Alzheimer's patients and other at-risk people, like, you know, children or something like that.
Yeah.
So they're studying that now. They're working on shrinking the size of the box that they have to track, so that it's actually, you know, it's physically convenient. And a big issue with them is the mobile battery power, how to power that thing over a long period of time.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny when you hear think about those original LoJack ads. You know, it seemed like it was about cops and your muscle car that could be getting stolen. But, you know, when you sort of pursue it and think about miniaturization, they're really pretty far. They're really right on the frontier. They're at a good place where a lot of possibilities could
open up. Oh, absolutely. Because conceptually, it's the same thing. It's how do you deliver that product, right?
Yeah.
And there's certain obvious technical challenges which I can't begin to approach on sort of the communication side, the signal side. But and the equally big for them is the challenge of the device itself. And if you go to LoJack and visit LoJack, just the evolution of their basic device is astonishing. The original box was the size of a small jewelry box that you might have at home to keep necklaces and bracelets, maybe 8 inches by 4 inches or something like that, or seven inches. And now we're getting down to something that's a little bit bigger than a pager. And or a deck of cards or something.
Oh, wow.
And if in the space of 5 years we've cut it more than in half, 40% the size, in 2 years, how much smaller is that going to be?
Yeah.
You know, the device out in Wisconsin that the elderly residents are carrying for their tracking is about the size of a large matchbook.
Really? Wow. Well, Andrew Caffrey, thank you very much. I hope you'll write more about this.
Oh, I'd love to track this in the future.
So, Rob Weissman, you just wrote a fascinating story about the Google effect. Could you describe what the Google effect is?
Well, it's something that I began hearing about from venture capitalists, DC. When companies come in to ask them for money now, they're asking the companies about Google.
Mm-hmm.
What's their strategy for Google? Especially companies that are in the internet space or the search space. They want to know, what's their strategy for dealing with Google? How are they positioning themselves relative to Google? Are they trying to compete with it? Are they trying to partner with it?
Mm-hmm.
Are they vulnerable to Google expanding into their space?
Yeah. So what kind of companies are most vulnerable to the Google effect? Let's take the negative side of it. Like, what kinds of businesses have to have a Google strategy, or else no one's going to give them any money?
Well, it's mostly companies that are in some form of the internet space, but it's sort of like Microsoft was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
In a sense that Google is moving quickly into a number of businesses and is rumored to be moving into others.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, they've almost become like a Rorschach test of your hopes and fears. And,
yeah.
They started out as a search engine.
Right.
Then they built up a business around advertising. Mm-hmm. They have a very strong advertising franchise, both through keywords and by providing contextual advertising on third-party sites.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're getting into Wi-Fi. They're building a Wi-Fi network, so they're threatening the telecommunications. They're also sort of building up an internet platform that they can run different software programs off of. So they could even, thought to be now a threat to companies like Microsoft and even enterprise software companies.
It's amazing when you think that they started with just that very simple, stripped down search page.
Yes.
And now they're in everything.
Yeah.
I guess it's the strength of that advertising model that they figured out. An advertising model that seems to scale and seems to be able to seems to work on a lot of different platforms and a lot of different levels.
Right. And it seems like right now the advertising model is still the key to their success, but they're expanding the platforms through which they can offer that model.
Yeah.
For instance, if they provide Wi-Fi for the city of San Francisco or other places, when you boot up a laptop computer within that Wi-Fi zone, I assume that it'll be going to Google and Google will be offering advertising on it.
Yeah. It's interesting. The other part of the flip side of having an advertising model is being able to offer things free. And that's another big strength of theirs. I heard when they kind of pitched the San Francisco, there were other people pitching that contract for low cost.
Yes.
And Google came in and just said,
we'll do it for free.
Yeah.
So that gives them a big advantage, obviously.
Yeah.
So I think companies that want to get into that space have to have a niche strategy.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be able to offer a specific type, say if it's a search, a specific type of search.
Yeah.
And there are companies, even in the Boston area, you've got Endica, which is... a company that's offering retail search inside the firewall of a retailer like a Home Depot or a Walmart.
Right.
So it helps you navigate within their site.
Right.
But they claim that that's more effective, that their technology is more effective because it's not based on the Google algorithm of basing everything on links.
I see, right.
Then there's also people search. There's a company in Boston called Zigs, which does people search, and they claim to be very strong in that niche.
Right.
And other types of niches.
Yeah.
And I think in the other side of the Google effect, though, is while some companies are having trouble getting funding because they're thought to be vulnerable to Google, the VCs are also very interested in anything in the internet space because they hope it will become the next Google.
Right, right.
So in some ways, some companies are getting funded now that might not have been funded a couple of years ago because they've seen the Google IPO and they've seen the growth of that internet space because of Google. And some of them are trying to swim in Google's wake.
Could it be that they don't want to be the next Google, but they want to be bought by Google?
That's another factor.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think especially for the VCs, the investors that are funding these companies, they see Google out there, they see Microsoft and Yahoo competing with it, trying to develop their own big internet networks.
Yeah.
And they're all looking for interesting search. One of them will offer a product in travel search or people search or whatever it is. And then the others will all want to build up the same business.
So yeah.
Sometimes the easiest way to do that or the fastest way is to acquire someone.
Yes, right. So if somebody comes up with a calendaring program and one of them buys it, then the other two are quickly scouring the landscape for, well, what's another calendaring? I mean, what are some of the things they've absorbed so far? I think all three went in on picture sharing.
Yep.
I remember Flickr and then Picasa. There's
mapping.
Field. Right.
Shopping. They're all doing shopping sites.
Yeah.
They all continue to add more and more sites to try to build up their franchise.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they don't have a natural bar to entry in the same way Microsoft did with its operating system.
So I think what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think Microsoft developed that when the Windows operating system, which was almost a monopoly, was actually called a monopoly by the federal government.
Right.
But whereas, I mean, people can still get into the search. I think Google's bar to entry is just its brand and the idea that it keeps expanding its brand.
Yeah.
So it's particularly important for them to be continually moving into new spaces.
Yeah.
Or at least to be afraid, feared to be moving into new spaces.
Speaking of fear, they seem to be fearless when you think about how they moved into maps. Everybody already had maps. Mapping was already out there, and people were sending party invitations with maps and MapQuest and all that. And then, you know, Google Earth came out, and all of a sudden everyone was like, whoa, we got to look at maps again.
Yeah.
This is a whole new take on it. And they just blew by all the competition. So they are a power out there. They seem to really be able to marshal some innovation and come in. The Wi-Fi thing, the same thing. I mean, there's all these Wi-Fi companies out there. And then when Google says they're getting into it, then people are like, uh-oh.
Right.
This might make me look dumb.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so I think Google has definitely become, in some ways, this decade's Microsoft, at least in terms of the company that's being admired, envied, feared by everybody in the industry. And that's what's creating the Google effect.
Do you think there's any, one of their most famous slogans was don't be evil. Do you think, is there any evolving sense that people are starting to think of Google as being not evil necessarily, but just, let's not feed this beast. They're ravenous, and they're kind of getting a negative connotation.
I think that's starting to happen. I think for a long time Google was admired, and they were sort of like the upstarts and the new young kids out of in the Stanford trailer.
Yeah.
And I think that they didn't have that connotation for a long time, but I think now the ubiquity of it, and the fact that that so many people use Google as their main connection to the internet, their main way of finding things on the internet.
Yeah.
I think there is this sort of this fear that they're they might know too much about you or something.
Oh yeah, that's right. Right.
You know that
right.
they yeah. You know they know what you search for.
Yeah.
You know now they'll be following everything you do if they become a if they have the Wi-Fi franchise.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some of that, the privacy concerns.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I'm not sure how strong that feeling is yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think people still like the product and and the company's still making a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I still I don't think that they're like Microsoft in the sense that people think that they're impermeable. I think that Microsoft once they won the desktop battle had this period of 5 years or so where it seemed like no one could touch them. And I think people still feel like Google is vulnerable just because you've got these other strong companies in that space.
Yeah.
And and all it takes is just a little bit of a shift in the market. And,
yeah.
And you can see Yahoo or Microsoft
getting a lead. Yeah, it strikes me that if you do a search on Yahoo or MSN or any of these other smaller companies, the search results are very close to Google's. Once in a while I'll be doing a search and I'm not quite getting what I want on Google, so I'll try some other ones. And it's remarkable how similar they are. And even Amazon's A9 or, some of these.
Because a lot of the others have stripped down their search engines, taken away the clutter of the portals to be more like Google.
Yeah, right. So they mimic the look.
Yes.
But also the results seem very similar. So I think that is a vulnerability for Google if somebody comes up with a snazzier brand or does an incredibly clever rollout or something. I could see people saying, "Oh, you use Google? Oh, I use this. I'm a little hipper," So I think they could be vulnerable in that regard.
And the other thing is that, as Bill Gates and others have pointed out many times, is that what Google does and what they're all doing primarily now is web search.
Yeah.
But that's as broadband evolves, there'll increasingly only one field of search.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're talking about scanning books, and cuts video is going to be. Is going to be a big field of search, and they're all starting to get into that. But if someone gets a lead or a good technology in that one of those areas, they could perhaps leapfrog Google.
Yeah, video search I could see being someone. That seems to me something that people think should work, but I bet a lot of people don't come home at night and spark up their video search engine to see what's on. But I could see that.
Not yet.
Not yet. But I could see if somebody comes up with the right, some company comes up with the right user interface, and then it's kind of tied into TiVo-like devices. I could see that happening. One misstep I thought that Google made in the don't be evil was when Eric Schmidt, when they sort of cut out CNET, they wouldn't talk to CNET because they had done a story on Eric Schmidt,
yes.
The CEO. I mean, I thought that was a stumble that they got a lot of bad publicity there.
And they finally started talking to him.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I didn't follow it. Yeah. They relented.
So they backed off.
Yeah, but they really looked bad then.
Yeah. One thing I can say, someone who's sort of covered Google intermittently, is they are less accessible now than they were prior to the IPO.
Hmm.
I think that as they become a well-capitalized company and they have no trouble getting press, and it seems as though they're sort of keeping the press at bay more than they had in the past.
Yeah, it does seem like that people have trouble getting into Google. They don't seem to be particularly press friendly, which is funny because they've benefited from such buzz. But yet they seem to be suspicious of the press, and I think Eric Schmidt is not necessarily a press-friendly guy.
Well, I think Eric Schmidt is—he's very much aware right now that as a public company, anything he says, to one publication that's not that would have a material effect, it could get him and land him in some trouble with Wall Street as well. So
yeah,
with the SEC.
Yeah. But there are people who are, who are in that same position, who seem to be able to have a way with it. Think about Jack Welch. I mean, what a master he was of, dealing with the press and being celebrated as this master of the universe. And, he was talking to the press a lot, on background, on the record, off the record. He had a very easy way with the press.
Yeah.
But that's hard. That's hard to do. It's hard to sort of
calibrate your accessibility and your comfort level.
Right.
It's like some of the Red Sox players. You know, you got your Kevin Millar,
right,
and then you've got Keith Folk.
Yeah.
You know, some guys just can't turn it on or don't feel comfortable. But anyway, I want to get to another story you wrote recently about a new nanotech initiative involving the Museum of Science. Can you explain what's going on with that?
The Museum of Science in Boston this week received a $20 million grant from the National Science Foundation to develop exhibits and educational programs around the emerging technology of nanotech, which is basically the engineering practice of working with the tiny materials and properties at the atomic and molecular levels. Boston already is a center for nanotechnology research. Harvard and Northeastern University and UMass Amherst all have programs or leading collaborations in research in that field. And what they're doing is by manipulating these tiny properties is they're creating very strong, durable, lightweight materials that can be used in everything from drugs to sporting equipment to oil refinery. A lot of people think it's a big field, but it has a very low profile with the public right now. So the National Science Museum is basically giving the largest grant they've ever given to a museum to try to get the word out that this is going to become an important science that people should keep their eye on.
Yeah, and get involved with maybe, and maybe is part of it to sort of get into the schools and to kind of increase awareness. You know, if you're a young chemist, if you're interested in physics, and you know, this is something you should be thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and I think there's a community of people out there who are very involved in it. And one of the things that the Museum of Science has sought to do already is to invite them to host presentations at the museum that are open to the general public.
Oh,
and in that way, I think they were already a leader in that, so they were basically chosen to lead this effort. But it's really a national effort. They're working with the Exploratorium in San Francisco and the Museum of Science in Minnesota, as well as other agencies to sort of develop these exhibits that would then rotate around or appear in science museums across the country.
Oh, that's interesting.
And part of what they would do, in addition to the exhibits, would be to host forums on issues that might result from nanotechnology. For instance, new drugs that are developed using nanotech, will they be patented? And then will the patent prevent them from being used in third world countries? You know, it's some of the same issues that have come up over AIDS drugs and other types of drugs. And there's also some concerns about toxicity of nanotech materials.
Oh.
We don't really know what kinds of, you know, whether or how hazardous they might be, but that's a field of inquiry. But that's, some of these are societal issues that need to be discussed. So I think that's part of what they want to do as well.
Yeah, I think it's, I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it, how they tackle it, because it will be interesting to see, you know, my sort of first take is I imagine all these, you know, microscopes and magnifying and somehow trying to sort of...
Well, that's the challenge.
Yeah, to get down to that level, to make that level feel real to people.
Right. You're dealing with materials that are invisible to the human eye.
Yeah.
So how do you create exhibits around them?
Yeah.
You know, they've already done some preliminary exhibits at the Museum of Science, and what they've really focused on is the products that use nanotechnology today. So you'll see a pair of pants that's stain resistant or water resistant. That's because it's coated with a thin coating developed through nanotech. And then tennis rackets will have strings that have become stronger because of nanotech properties. So they'll show you that kind of thing. But I think what they're thinking of now is something even more ambitious, where they would use atomic force microscopes and joysticks that would enable like visitors to the museum to manipulate some of these molecular properties themselves.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. And to, you know, to come full circle, I think one of the most compelling benefits of nanotech is it's unlikely Google's going to get into that.
Well, you never know with Google.
Yeah. Hey, well, thanks a lot, Rob.
All right, TC. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player.